And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a room with couches and chairs in the bowels of what will always be on this podcast, the Air Canada Centre, and not the stupid Bank Arena, where I am joined, because the moment calls for it, by my favorite Canadian three-man weave partners, Bruce Arthur of the Toronto Star, Eric Kareen of TheAthletic.com. Here we are.
He just shrugged. He's trying to save his voice.
So I didn't think we would be here so soon in the series. The Raptors, the Toronto Raptors, the team that had dinosaurs on their jerseys at one point, the team that drafted Andrea Bargnani number one and had him in pasta commercials that were very silly, is one win away from the NBA championship. Now, I will say, they better not screw around with this game, because Durant may or may not come back. The Warriors remain very mysterious about this. He's been cleared to practice. Hurrah. Let's see what happens. And by the way, that's not meant to be sarcastic. Like, Kevin Durant's injured. It's a serious injury. It's a real injury. He has a calf injury that's very tricky. But if he comes back and gets on the court and discovers, oh, hey, I feel all right, and the Raptors lose tomorrow, then you go to Golden State for game six. No one should want any part of a game seven. So let's just get that out of the way. This must be, as two people who have chronicled this team for years and years, this must be just insane. Like, can you register that this is happening?
I've said this before. The second game story I ever wrote about the Toronto Raptors was game five in Detroit, and Chris Childs forgot the score, and Keon Clark smoked a cigarette in the shower after the game, and I didn't know what I was looking at. And I've watched this team since then. Others have watched it longer and covered it longer. This has happened fast, and it's happened extraordinarily slow. And I believed this team could get to this point, but like you, I didn't think it was going to happen in a game five. This is something new in basketball in Canada, for the Toronto Raptors, for those of us who cover this team. And it's unexpected, but at the same time, there have been times this season where I thought this team could do this.
We've gotten to the point now.
Boy, your voice, you're really suffering here. It's been a long playoff run.
Yeah, and I only have two more speaking engagements today, too, so it's gone well. We've gotten to the point where, and little inside journalism here, when the team you cover is one win away from winning the championship, you have to start thinking about what that story might look like and the themes you want to hit on. You just can't let the moment wash over you if you want to get something up somewhat timely. And the thing that occurred to me is that the conference was the goal for so long. And I think that's why you saw the outpouring of emotion from both the fans on the streetcars, but also Kyle Lowry, you know, that sort of him not being able to contain a smile, which I'm sure killed him to not be able to do. Like, that was the point for so long. And they'd run in, whether it was at the conference championship level or before, they'd run into LeBron for so long. And they accomplished this great thing against Milwaukee. And now I find myself like 10 days later or whatever it is saying, wait, what the hell's happening? What's going on?
I think everybody is. I really think when they won game four, and this is part of what I wrote about, I think everyone within the NBA looked at each other and said, wait a second, the Raptors are one win away from the NBA championship? Like, they had this seven-game bloodbath against the Sixers, a six-game really tough series that they had to – you know, it feels easy now because they won four straight, but double overtime game three and their season is over if they lose that game. Game six here – down 15 late in the third quarter. Not an easy series. Two really, really good teams. And you get through that and you take a deep breath and, oh, wow, we're in the finals. And then it's like, bam, 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 bam. Wait a second. It's come fast.
What Kareen said is really accurate in that during the DeMar and Kyle years, this team never could look itself in the mirror and say, we could win a title. What they could tell themselves is, like, if you really got them to tell the truth, we'd like to make the NBA final and stand next to the guys who are going to win it.
Well, this has been my point for years now, is like, there were those Raptors, the pre-Kawhi Raptors, were compared often to the Clippers of CPM Blake Griffin.
Yep.
And I've heard comparisons to the Paul George Pacers, the sort of also Rans who never could get over the hump. They were never as good as those teams. The Paul George Pacers took LeBron to the hilt, to game seven, to the point that you can look back at a coaching decision to take Roy Hibbert off the floor and say that that cost you a series against LeBron. The Clipper teams that we all make fun of, those were championship caliber teams who happened to live in a hellacious conference as a dynasty was rising in Oakland. These Raptors were like squeaking by the Pacers, like with Paul George and not much else, and squeaking by the Heat that weren't very good and getting curb stomped by LeBron and mocked. Like they were not as good as those other teams.
And they still, it happened again when they added Serge Ibaka and PJ Tucker. And it happened again when they were the best team in the conference, a 59 win team. And it happened in 7 days. And they got the, what I always say about the Raptors is this team's history, when you go back 24 years, has been one in which stars leave, there's incompetence, there's absurdity, and then when they got good, they became a joke. They became, by the end of their seasons, something people in the NBA would make fun of because they weren't close.
LeBronto.
Exactly. It was that Dan Le Batard line after LeBron hit all those turnaround shots, remember the torturous turnaround shots in game two? And he said, this looks like so much fun for everybody except the Raptors.
I think last year was really the first time where they could honestly say, you know, we might be able to beat LeBron this time.
They tricked me. I picked them to win in seven, partly because of how bad the Cavs looked against Indiana.
And that Cavs team was super flawed. They took the, you know, we're not going to play defense for a full year, to a whole new level, and I forget what they were going into, what they were through the regular season, but it went from like bad to abysmal through the regular season. And then you, to see the same shortcomings, be revealed, it's funny, we're sitting here on, you know, the precipice of something potentially great, and you can't help but reflect on, you know, the times where the iteration of this franchise that for so long was the, you know, the best thing that had ever happened to this franchise just couldn't get over the hump. And it's, that gets to the point though, that it's so odd for this to have changed so quickly. And I know you said both slow and quick, but, you know, the goal was reached and it coincided with Golden State's injuries and the free agent situation with Kevin Durant, to the extent that that's affected things, we'll never be able to know fully. And I mean, timing's just such a big part of everything that happens. And it really advocates for, you know, not tanking all the time and kicking the ball down the road. Like, isn't the worst strategy?
This team is in some ways, and this is, I'm working on a column about this, so I don't want to spoil it totally, but in some ways, a living argument for staying good. Now, in other ways, I don't think they're an argument for that, and that's what I don't want to spoil, but they are in some ways a sort of living monument to the power of being like a good team and staying good. And everyone who said, you know, this is why you don't break up a 55-win Clippers team, because as good as the Warriors are, you may run into them at a time when someone is injured. Kevin Durant is injured. Klay Thompson is injured but playing. Andre Iguodala is injured but playing. The rest of their bench has fallen. Kevon Looney is in as a whatever he's got and is playing. DeMarcus Cousins is recovering and plainly does not belong on the floor in the NBA Finals. Like, they've caught them at the right time, but that pre-Kawhi, it wouldn't have mattered. They wouldn't have had a shot against this team.
No, but it's also an argument for the track that Masai Ujiri has taken with this team, which is he built what I would describe as an upper middle class team. That's what those Raptors teams were every year. They weren't like luxury additions. They were upper middle class teams that sometimes looked better than they were, but they used the twin track of development as that was happening. So it's not really a model you can follow. Go get Pascal Siakam at 27. Good luck. He might be the best player from that draft when it's all said and done. That's a hard thing to do. But this team never stopped acquiring talent and developing talent, getting a G League team that you could keep an eye on. And so when they got to the moment, every good team, if you want to take that jump to the next level, you need a talent upgrade, right? There are very few teams in the last 40 years that have won without a past future or present MVP on their roster. You can count them on one hand. Like the Detroit Pistons teams, and that's about it.
It's very rare.
Everybody else. You need one of those guys. But that means you need enough talent and enough kind of cultural significance and enough organizational stability that when the moment arrives, you can make that deal. And that's what the Raptors did, is everything Masai Ujiri built, right up until the point where the San Antonio Spurs said yes, was necessary for the San Antonio Spurs to say yes. They needed to have traded Andrea Bargnani and gotten the number 9 pick and drafted Jakob Poeltl and had him be an important part of the bench.
Jake Poeltl.
And they needed
Norman.
And they needed DeMar DeRozan to keep getting better and for them to keep developing him as a player, and they needed to believe in him, and they needed all these things to happen so that they could have a chance to have a chance. And that has carried them to where they are now.
You use the word luxury, and it's funny, and I think mostly coincidental, because it's just the way the contracts played out, that this is the first year they've paid into the luxury tax. And I mean, you can, and that's because this is when Norm Powell's contract kicked in. Like, that's the only reason.
Nice to have a finals run when you're paying into the luxury tax.
Yeah.
Cause nice for nice for them.
Yeah. But
someone told me today, by the way, it's costing $4,000 to get in the door for game 5. Last night I heard 2, and today from someone who would know, I heard 4 to get in the door.
There are 2 courtside seats that were up for sale that were $60,000 each.
I mean, 4 to get in the door and sit in section 3. But it's a good view. That's one of the good things about basketball, is like you get a good view up there. But I mean, like $1,000, I'd be like, if I love the Raptors, $1,000, like that hurts, but I can part with that. 4 is like a nice used car. Like 4 is a lot of money.
Yeah. A lot of season seat holders are making their purchases back in this playoff run by selling their seats.
You want to say, how can you sell your seats if you've been a season ticket holder? That means you've committed so much to this team, and the moment for them is on the precipice, but they still got to pay. It's not like you get to pay $100 but your normal season seat price for your seat. You still got to pay whatever it costs.
The time to make your money back was like game 3 and 4 against Milwaukee. Like, that's when you make your money back. This is the moment where, if we can back out for just 1 second, and I think we've talked about this a little bit before. If you grew up loving basketball in this country, you were an other. It has always been that way.
Now they're more popular than the Blue Jays, I think, right?
Yeah.
Kareen is saying maybe not.
The Blue Jays topped out around 4 million, 4.2, 4.3, but that was for the American League Championship Series, wasn't a World Series game.
I mean, this gets into the conversation of metrics and what are we using. Like, if you look at TV ratings, I think the Jays, if they were to go to the World Series, their numbers would probably be bigger in Canada than the Raptors would be. But also, TV ratings is one metric that skews old. And if you consider whatever other metric you want to use, whether it's Facebook likes or streams or whoever knows what else, I think it's pretty equal, at least.
The Blue Jays are playing today. And
they are terrible.
They were, I don't know if they're terrible. I will say there was all people walking to the game. Blue Jays uniforms are nice. That nice shade of blue is nice. But I'll tell you know what's growing on me? The red North uniforms that the Raptors have been wearing on the road a lot. I don't know if they've lost a game in those uniforms, by the way.
You might be right, actually.
The red version of that, when they first unveiled that, it looks like a lighter red to me. Like, it almost looks pink on TV. They're just nice. They're not audacious. It's a very nice, clean, it's grown on me. I think it's a very important finals analysis. It's grown on me.
But what is happening right now is,
you're gonna go back to serious cultural talk now.
Talk about how they look like the Atlanta.
What is happening now is, the important thing is, they're not using Drake jerseys during the finals. But the next thing is, this is a moment. And whether or not they win this series, this is a moment that basketball's never had in this country. Because if you grew up in this country loving basketball, hockey was the monoculture. It was the dominant church. And you were a small sect. And you might have had friends who loved basketball. You might have gotten, like me, VHS tapes of dazzling dunks and basketball bloopers. I shook hands with Frank Layden at game.
Yeah, he was here for game two. Game two.
And told him, like, he's one of the reasons I became a sports writer because he's one of the reasons I love basketball is because Frank Layden was hilarious on Dazzling Dunks and Basketball Bloopers. And that was how Canadian kid like me could access the NBA. And what's happened now is you have a team that after all these years for the Raptors has passed every test to this point. And the tests, as you mentioned, in the Philly series, the Milwaukee series, those were near-death experiences. And if you're a Raptors fan, your team has never gotten past that. And now they're at a moment where they have a chance to win a title.
People, it's that time of year again, basketball's home stretch. This is where all the hard work pays off when we see who's tough enough to be crowned the champion of the NBA. It's where players are more driven than ever to go further, faster, and longer. And that's what drives Goodyear to make tires that do the very same thing. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's on the road or on the basketball court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear, more driven. Well, let's talk about the last test then, because this is a test. This is the Golden State Warriors. This is a team that, look, game four had a feel of, and this is what makes the playoffs so interesting, because you never know when it's going to come. Game four, the second half, when the Raptors scored 63 points, had the feel of they broke the Warriors' will. Draymond Green gets upset, has a technical. They can't get any stops. Kawhi is rolling over them, doing whatever he wants. And by the way, we can talk about it. I thought it was the best passing game the Raptors played, period, since acquiring Marcus Gasol, considering the opposition and the level of importance. It was a beautiful performance by them. It had the feel of they gave in. And seldom do you see a game like that that has that feel and the team recovers to come back. Now, this is not a normal team. This is a three-time champion. This is 3-4 seeking a three-peat now with all these Hall of Famers, one of whom may or may not come back. I don't think we're going to know until tip-off. Well, maybe, who knows, but that's my guess. And if there's a team that can look themselves in the mirror and say, hey, why? Well, hold on for a second, why not? Like, all we got to do is win game five here, and then it's not that hard. You win a road game, then we go home. We should win at home. Now, we just got curb-stomped at home twice, but we should win at home. We can talk ourselves into that. And then game seven, you just talk yourself into, hey, we're champions. So let's talk about the series. Like, what strikes you as something Golden State can do to win here tomorrow?
Well, they could have Kevin Durant come back.
That would help. Okay, that's one.
How much would it help is the question that I have.
Well, I mean, we'll see when he gets on the floor, right?
But what we're talking about today being cleared for practice, and he's not out there shooting with the team, we're talking about him scrimmaging with end-of-the-bench guys. We're not talking about Kevin Durant in shape. We're not talking about Kevin Durant sharp. We're talking about a guy who has... This will be the first time he's been on a court that we know of with other players.
And it's tempting to say, as I have said, that not being Alphonso McKinney is valuable because you have to guard Kevin Durant even if he's just standing there doing nothing. But I think that's partly true. But you also have to run back on defense and make cuts and get rebounds and get, you know, tip out gang rebounds and all these things you have to do against a really great team. And all of that stuff requires you to cut and change directions and move around a lot. And maybe he gets out there and he says, yeah, I can make some standstill jumpers, but I can't do all this other stuff. And maybe then you're not that much more than Alphonso McKinney. I don't know.
And what's he doing on defense? If he's in the role we all assumed when he got back and defending Kawhi,
I think you assume that's not his role. Even
which seems impossible. Yeah. Exactly. Like, that's almost a non-starter if his calf is anything less than 90%
Is say we've decided that we're going to split the Kawhi matchup between Andre Iguodala and Klay Thompson. Maybe Andre started on him, I believe, in game four. Klay guards him a lot. But, okay, so Kevin can't do that, but maybe he also allows us to start our best lineup, the lineup that we haven't been able to play at all in this series, they haven't been able to play that literal death lineup at all. But maybe he unlocks that in a way that hasn't been possible. But Iguodala is interesting to me because they lose game four the way they did. And everyone's you know, Steph is not, what Steph goes 9-for-22 and gets hammered. Like a bad Steph game. Can't afford a bad Steph game. Steph looks tired. We need more Steph pick and rolls. We'll talk about all that. Andre Iguodala, they are at a stage where they cannot get 3 points from Andre Iguodala in 38 minutes. He needs to get 11. He doesn't need to get 20. That number needs to be like 12 or 11. He cannot be on the floor for 38 minutes and score 3 points, which is interesting because Lowry, I thought, played a splendid game in game four, and he scored 10 points. And it's amazing. And he played like he did all the Kyle Lowry things. He pushed it in transition and created trailing threes for people. Hit floaters on the pick and roll. His passing, his extra passing, his hockey assists, Canadian team hockey assists. And then you're like, wow, what a luxury it is for Kyle Lowry to be able to have a splendid game by scoring 10 points because Pascal Siakam gets 19, Serge Ibaka gets 20. And like, that's what's not happening for the Warriors.
Well, and Bruce came on after he was being a big shot in covering hockey because that's most important here. I've been covering it since Orlando game one.
I did technically cover Orlando game two.
Yeah.
The sphincter game, the annual, the sphincters are going to be
a sphincters weren't as clenched for game two against Orlando as past sphincter clenching game twos. In game one against Orlando, Lowry had a 0 point game and, you know, we did the usual Kyle Lowry dance and how we try to appreciate him. But the thing I was going to say is that in so many ways during this run, people have been asking Nick Nurse, people have been asking Kawhi Leonard, people have been asking Kyle Lowry, people have been asking every Raptors figure, how much does Kawhi Leonard's aura, the way he carries himself, his apparent calm and don't give a shitness, does it go over to his teammates? And nobody can answer that. Like, you can guess, but I think the thing that happens is he carries the load that he carries so well, and that load is so formidable that all of a sudden Kyle Lowry's in the right place. He's carrying the proper amount, and he also doesn't have to run, you know, however many pick and rolls a game. Pascal Siakam can operate on the other side, and when things aren't going well at the start of game four against Draymond or Iguodala, he can just keep on bringing it on defense and see where he fits into a game. And Marc Gasol, if he has the yips with one, or not the yips, but the occasional Marc Gasol, I'm not shooting.
The persnickety Marc Gasol.
That's okay, because there are other guys that'll shoot, and Kawhi will score in what could have been a disastrous first quarter. He'll keep you afloat by being, you know, hitting some tough shots, and then you're still in the game. So Kawhi Leonard has just made the load for everybody else, which is what superstars do, so much more manageable.
Turns out having arguably the best player in the league is super duper helpful.
It is very helpful. The funny thing, if you look at Kyle's numbers in these playoffs, they're not that eye-popping, right? Like, he's averaging, I haven't looked at him today, but like 14 points, percentages are okay. He's given you some decent rebounding and assist and steal numbers. But I think this is the playoffs where people have appreciated Kyle more than in previous runs. And he had, as he has told me and others, he had good numbers last year and the year before, and basically everywhere from about game two of the Miami series in 2016.
That Miami series was the worst. It was just the worst. It was the, if you went back and watched the Miami Toronto game from, was that 2016 or 2016?
2016.
You would be like, this is worse than, this is almost as bad as like Phoenix, Sacramento late in like a typical Sacramento season. A
glorious,
like not last season when the Kings were actually fun to watch.
Glorious moment in Raptors history, yes. But Kyle, Draymond Green said it before this series that now he's in the perfect spot. Kyle has never been a guy who can carry an entire team by himself because he lacks the physical gifts to be able to cut through the hardest moments in the NBA. He is not 7 feet tall like Kevin Durant. He is not built like Giannis Antetokounmpo. He is not as strong or as powerful as Kawhi Leonard with that size. He doesn't have those things, but he has all these other things he can give you. Watch, I've said it over and over, watch Kyle Lowry block out a big guy. It's awesome. Like the little things he does.
My favorite Lowry moment from game four was after a made basket, hard push, which he did this many mm-hmm. times after a make, hard push, get deep enough in the lane that he draws help. Even though he's still kind of covered, but like the center, I think it was Looney, just instinctively, all right, this guy's mm-hmm. near the basket, I gotta be there. Kick out to Marc Gasol, who's open. I can't remember if Gasol shot or he swung it to someone else who shot. Someone shoots a three. Kyle, because he's under the rim, is like, well, I'm going to try and get this offensive rebound. Mm-hmm. And drew an over-the-back foul on someone because they couldn't get around him, and he boxed him out. And, like, that's a very, like, he either produces a three or he keeps the possession alive. It's a very Kyle play.
Kyle is a guy who figured out that if you call a timeout while dribbling straight down the middle of the court, you get to decide which side of the court you inbound the ball on.
He was the one who figured that out.
Nick Nurse said that Kyle was the one who kind of went, hey, we can do that.
Would have been useful against the Nets 5 years ago.
Yes, it would. Not all things come when you need them. But he does all these little things. Like that game in game four, the passing and the creation and the way he acted as the brain on the floor for that offense was essential. The way Serge Ibaka is at his best when Kyle Lowry is finding him in the places where Serge Ibaka is.
Serge,
good.
By the way, let me give Serge some credit. Serge is not a natural field guy the way some of the other guys on the team are. In Oklahoma City, there was no playmaking. He was so mechanical that he couldn't do anything when he got the ball in open space. He has thrown in the last two games 7 or 8 of the best passes of his career. And not just a simple catch, turn to the wing shooter that I know is there, throw a pass like on time, which he did too, but like under the rim, catching the ball in a place where normally he'd finish, immediate kick out, and not to the guy in the corner, but turn around and hit the guy that's at the top of the arc. Like no one paid those passes off. They mostly led to missed threes. But Serge, he's worked at it. He's a proud guy. He's not a good passer, but he's good enough. In this series, anyway.
In game three in the second quarter, I think I tweeted, has Serge Ibaka played in this series yet? And since then, he's been awesome. And, you know, there are lots of ways to look at this series, but DeMarcus Cousins is, for all intents and purposes, except literal purposes, is the Warriors' backup center, kind of. Even though he's starting, he's playing backup minutes, 15, 18, except for game two. Ibaka is the Raptors' backup center, and who's won that matchup over the last few games. Back to Lowry, this is just, you know, as somebody who's, I mean, he's the most interesting guy on the team to write about, because he's so cagey and his game is so nuanced. And when the conversations have come over the past few years about him not stepping up in these moments, I've, you know, had to shift over to defender mode to a little bit, or, you know, the Raptors just don't have enough talent around him to put him in his proper role. And I'm just sort of glad to see him used in a spot where he can show the world how smart and physical and savvy he is at this game, because I don't think people understand, who aren't paying attention, understand why this guy is an all-star, has been a 5-time all-star. And sure, it's, you know, he put up bigger numbers earlier in this all-star run, but it's that other stuff that makes him an exceptional player.
He also had the on another hard push after a make. He also did the Nash under the basket, mm-hmm. and then immediate stop, pivot, spin, totally fooled whoever was on him and drew a foul at the rim. But you'd say what you want to say, and then I want to talk about the Warriors.
So, well, there's little things like they had a chance to run a 2-for-1 in game four and they didn't because Kyle wasn't on the floor, because Kyle's a guy who always recognizes 2-on-1s. But I sat down with Kyle at one point during these playoffs and I told him, like, you're having a really good playoffs. And he says, all people see is game one against Orlando and game three against Philadelphia.
I mean, he's wrong.
He is wrong, but that's how he sees it. Because I think that the criticism that Kyle received during the run in 2016 in those games, remember after game one in Miami where he's out on the court shooting with his hoodie on because he'd had just an awful shooting game and he had an awful shooting series against Indiana. He takes that really personally and feels it and holds it. Maybe it's partly because he needs it as motivation, but he feels like what people see when they look at him is, did I make shots or not? And that's all they remember. And he knows, and I think we know, and I think people really do – The more you watch him, the more you appreciate it. He's a winning player in so many little ways, in all those ways that are difficult but not impossible to quantify. And having him on this team where so many different guys can be the second guy from night to night, where you can get great performances from Pascal Siakam or Marc Gasol. You can get a 6-3 night from Danny Green.
Speaking of Siakam.
Having Kyle is so, so essential.
One of the things that I'm very impressed with, and then we're going to talk about the Warriors, is I was talking to this with a Toronto official like 30 minutes ago. Everyone knows I love Siakam. I've been on the driving the bandwagon. Even so, I thought we'd get to the playoffs and his bad games would be like 8 points. He's giving you 15 every night. His bad games are 12, 13, 14. He is giving you like what I said about Iguodala. They can't afford 3 points from Andre. They just can't afford it. They don't have to worry about that with Pascal. Even if his jumper's off, he's still giving you 12, 13, 14, 15. I thought one of the biggest plays of the game in game four, you know, Kawhi comes out and hits those two threes. The Raptors take the lead. People have already, like, Golden State punched back. Golden State got the lead back. And Pascal, after a defensive rebound, went coast to coast in the middle of the third quarter and won over Draymond Green. One of the best defenders, if not the best defender in the league, went right at him, knocked him over. It was a block and won. I mean, that was a play. That's a star play. And it gave the Raptors the lead back. I believe they were down two. To go at Draymond Green like that and finish and hit the free throw, that's a star play. And Pascal hasn't been a superstar in these playoffs. He hasn't had to be, but he's been a presence every game in the scoring column. Forget everything else, in the scoring column.
There was one game where that wasn't true, and it was, I believe, game two against Philadelphia, where he had, if I remember it, I have to go back, because this is now a lifetime.
Like, that was
a
playoff, when they put Embiid on him.
Yeah, 8 points, one rebound is what I remember. And after that game, the team went to him and said, look, the scoring can come and go. You can't have one rebound. You've got to be Pascal Siakam all over the court. Because at his best, remember how after game one, the Warriors were saying, boy, this is a really fast team. There's one fast guy on this team. There's one guy on the Raptors who's super fast. But Siakam puts so much pressure on you with that. And defensively, they're long and they're everywhere. They are long.
That's him.
And they're everywhere. But a lot of it is Siakam filling gaps and getting out and closing off lanes. He has such an impact on the game, but he has to play him. And that Philly game was one of the only ones where he didn't do that. And since then, the moments that he has had are still overshadowed by Kawhi. But he's just, and you don't want to fall into the lazy Jordan Pippen thing. He's been as close to a Pippen as you can kind of get on this team.
Six of the seven games of the Philly series, Joel Embiid is his primary defender. Six games against Milwaukee, Giannis Antetokounmpo is his primary defender. First of all, that's just unbelievable experience, whatever happened in this Raptors run. But you get to Golden State, and they're obviously full of intelligent, great defenders, but nobody who's just going to challenge you at the rim in the same way,
right,
and prevent you from getting your shot off in the same way.
He's not scared of Draymond.
And nor should he. I mean, Draymond's awesome.
Most people are scared of Draymond.
But he knows where his shots are. And he, as I mentioned, in game four, he was able to impact the game in so many ways that when he did look nervous and sort of jumbly to start the game.
Ooh, jumbly. I like that. Jumbly.
He's able to settle back, watch Kawhi do his business, and then get into a different flow once the Raptors find it. It's been such a, I mean, not the consistent type performance we saw in the regular season, obviously, but knowing you're going to get those points, and especially in this series, knowing he's going to find a way to get a few easy baskets. He raced down to get a post position on Sean Livingston.
And
they're taking advantage of it fully when he gets
got, even Andre, he's got Andre Iguodala on him, or he's going right to the block and he's scoring.
Listeners, you know I like anything that can save me time, and SeatGeek has emerged as the go-to time saver for buying tickets to anything, NBA playoffs, any other sporting event, concerts, comedy shows, Broadway shows, more. SeatGeek has all the tickets you're looking for. It searches the entire secondary market almost and puts it all in one place that's super easy to use. It rates every deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It has an interactive seating map so you know exactly where your seat is, whether anything's in the way, all of that stuff. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. They help me get tickets to Hamilton, which is a tough ticket to get. SeatGeek will, for now, even give you $10 off your first purchase. All you need to do is use the promo code I'm about to tell you about. Got to download the SeatGeek app, use promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOWE for $10 off your first purchase on SeatGeek.
The easiest way for the Warriors to get back in the series, obviously, like, Durant plays. Andre makes some shots, like 12 points. Quinn Cook, I thought if there was a low-key villain for the Warriors in Game 4, Quinn Cook got 5 good jump shot looks and missed all of them. Like, it can't happen. They can't. They're too thin. He can't afford that. Draymond has had a B-minus series, I think. Maybe a B-minus. He has 20 turnovers in 4 games. And the Raptors, who were a good team at forcing turnovers in the regular season, not a great one, are, I believe the Warriors' turnover rate is 17% of their possessions in this series, which would have been the worst in the league in the regular season. They got to clean all that up. Play, if they have Durant, play better lineups, play their best lineups. That helps. I do wonder if it's time to finally just start Kevon Looney. I've been saying this for 2 weeks. Cousins is not ready. Maybe to 2 days off help. I don't know. And you know, there's been this outcry of they need, every time the Warriors lose, it's always because Steph hasn't run more pick and roll. Let's have more pick and roll, more pick and roll. So here are the actual numbers. In game 4, Steph took 31, ball screens. I think if I'm looking at my notes right. 31. His average for the series is 35. So, okay, so maybe it's like 4 or less. His average for the season was 28. So that makes sense. He's run more ball screens since Durant got hurt. I think his high number is around 40. So maybe 31's a little low. His MVP seasons were 33 in the unanimous one and 38 per 100 possessions the year before. So like 31 is not some crazy underutilized outlier. And I just don't know if more Steph on the ball, at least running pick and roll. Now you could talk me into like maybe just let him ISO, maybe just let him burn Fred VanVleet off the dribble and see what happens. But you know what happens? 5 dudes converge on him, and Draymond Green shoots a 3-pointer off the side of the backboard. I just don't think with the level of shooting that they have around him without KD that a Steph pick and roll is some magic elixir. That running 50 of them is going to change. The Raptors know what to do. They know who to help off of. They know when they need to start pressing those guys because they turn into screening and handoff threats. They just know how to do this. And I understand why the smart Warriors fans always want more Steph on the ball. They're right. I think that's a generally been a correct thing. I just don't think A, it was underutilized as much as people said in game 4, and B, I just don't think it's a magic elixir that's going to flip the series on its head.
This is the problem with playing a team that has the best defense in the NBA, which is what the Toronto Raptors have. One of my favorite little details about the series is early on, Draymond would do that thing where he hits that hard first dribble and then throws a little lob to the center when you come over to help.
Yep.
And what the Raptors figured out is he's going to throw that lob a lot. How many of those have they knocked away in the last three games?
They had a stretch, I think, in game 3 where they knocked two in a row away in like a span of a minute.
They're so smart. Like one of the most, we've all written about this, but it's so fun and interesting to watch. Marc Gasol is a basketball genius. When he got here, they kind of said, Mark, this is what Kyle likes to do. And Mark said, I know. And they said, okay, these are kind of some of our defensive coverages. He's like, I know. He knows. Like he's not a basketball computer quite, but he's something close to it. Kyle's such a smart defender. Kawhi is a genius level defender. Danny Green is an all-league level defender or close to it, and Siakam's going to be. All of that, plus good schemes, means that they, as this series has gone on, what you've seen is they've adjusted to some of the things the Warriors have done.
Nick Nurse is a really interesting coach. Mm-hmm. So I said this on my last podcast, so I won't belabor it here, but starting Fred VanVleet in the second half of Game 3, Eric, you wrote about this in your most recent piece. I just don't remember a coach doing something like that with a lead and when the guy he's replacing is playing well as Danny Green was, I just don't – like all people are going to remember is the box in one because it's gimmicky and everyone can see that. That was a very gutsy and interesting decision. Even things like at the start of game three, they posted Marc Gasol up a lot on DeMarcus Cousins. I did not see that coming and I did not think it was smart. And the first time they did it, it didn't work. And the second, third, fourth, and fifth times they did it, it worked. When in game four, you know, the Warriors love to do this thing where they post up Draymond and they call it head tap. That's the name of the play. They post up Draymond and then two guys screen for each other off the ball and Steph pops open for a three or Klay pops open for a three. They hard trapped that in the post out of nowhere just to say, you don't know what's coming. Like we on a moment's notice, we might just totally do something out of the blue. And he's just coached since the middle of the Philly series, which got off to a shaky start. I think, he just does stuff that's really interesting. Posting Gasol, like it worked. They saw something or felt something that indicated to them, if we go to this a lot, it's going to work and it's going to wear them down. Like, and I just did not see that coming and didn't think it was smart and it worked.
Nick is very comfortable looking stupid. Not that he looks stupid, but he's not worried about the potential that he might. And, you know, the box and one comes out and, you know, Steph calls it janky. Nick's like, I don't care. It worked. We almost had a possession with down two.
Wild.
You know, and uses it again in game four to say, hey, Steve, you can't rest Klay Thompson in this game anymore. Sorry. Or else we're just going to do the same thing. He chased Klay Thompson back onto the floor, and Klay had an air ball or close to it near the end of the
and
game.
By the way, Klay.
He was awesome.
Klay, again, it's like Steph's 47-point game will be lost. For Klay to come back, and I think he had 28 on like 10 of 18 or something like that. 6 of 10 from 3, if I'm remembering right. I don't have it in front of me. And he moved well. I mean, maybe he's just Wolverine, but it wasn't like he was limping, right? He was moving well. He was chasing guys well. Awesome performance.
Yeah. Awesome. I think I tweeted out that he was a deity at some point in the third and fourth quarter. So I'm not taking anything away from him. But by the end of that game, he and Steph both missed some jumpers in the fashion that we are not used to them missing jumpers by quite a bit. Could have been bad luck. Could have been that they were tired. But the load on them has been so much because A, the Raptors' depth, and B, the way that they're playing and the way that Nick Nurse has them playing. The whole team, and this starts with Nurse, is just so versatile and smart enough to be versatile, to where you can use that willingness to look dumb in the pursuit of surprising your opponent or, you know, confusing your opponent. They're smart enough to where you can really use that and go at it repeatedly and get your opponent in a state of, you know, it only takes 1 or 2 seconds to throw off a possession, right?
The other little thing I forgot to mention was first two games of the series, Golden State, now this is according to our tracking numbers, which are not perfect, but they're close, 159 off-ball screens. The Raptors switched 17 of those 159. In the last two games, they've switched 35 combined, twice as many. And they made a clear decision. When Steph sets a back screen for somebody, we're going to switch that more because we're just getting killed on back cuts. It's like just a little thing. And they did that without, and this goes to your point, Bruce, about the IQ of the team. They did that without having to say, well, now we just have to switch everything because our guys are going to get confused because we can't switch this one thing, but not everything else. They did that. It's an isolated thing. We're going to switch that. Everything else, guys, do what you're doing. And people were, okay, got it. Let's go.
I asked an assistant before the series started, and I think it was an oddly specific question. It was like, if they go Draymond, Steph, pick and roll with Klay, can you guard that and get out to any shooters who are there? And the guy looked at me and said, the great thing about this, the fun thing about this, is the answer is always yes with this team. Like what Nick said against Milwaukee when it was, you have to collapse and keep Giannis from the rim and get out to their shooters. And he said, they said, you have to decide. He went, I want everything. I want it all. because this team is capable of doing that. One of the big, one of the great, interesting races in this series has been Golden State has genius level players, right? I mean, Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala are probably two of the smarter guys in the league. Steph has seen it all. Clay has seen it all. This is a really smart team.
Yep.
And the Raptors, meanwhile, Marc Gasol, Kawhi Leonard, Kyle Lowry, Danny Green, Fred VanVleet. It's a race between them and their coaches to see who can figure out and take away the things they want to take away first. And against Milwaukee, the Raptors took things away over and over and over and over as the series went on. One of the problems Draymond's having in this series, I think, is when is Draymond difficult is when he's getting to the rim with a head of steam and options, right? Where he can either get all the way to the rim because he's not going to beat you from the perimeter, or he finds somebody. The Raptors just had to deal with that with Giannis, who's a far more difficult kind of opponent trying to do the same thing. So everything that they've kind of seen gets you to this point. Giannis, after that series, told Eric Nemeth of The Athletic, like, he's seen Kawhi and Gasol every time he sees a double team from now on. These guys make life really difficult, and they adjust so well. So Nick, his big mistake in the Philly series was he trusted his starting five a little too much against Philly's starting five. He thought his starting five, because it had been an annihilating force, would be able to make up for any difference of his bench going against Joel Embiid coming back on the floor. And he was wrong, and then he adjusted.
Yep.
But Eric is right. At the beginning of this season, Nick Nurse said, I'm not going to coach scared. And what you've seen up to the highest levels of this game is he has not coached scared. It helps when you have maybe the best player in the game and incredibly smart players. But he's been a huge part of it too.
Listen up, people. We have a big favor to ask, and we promise it won't take too much of your time. Everyone knows I care about time very much. I don't waste your time. Our show is supported by some fantastic sponsors, and we'd love to hear your feedback. Head to podcastlisteners.com and fill out a short anonymous survey. That's it. We swear again. That's podcastlisteners.com. I'm glad you brought up their help on Giannis, because in every series that the Raptors have played, including this one, we keep hearing this discussion of, how much help should you send toward Kawhi? Should you just let Kawhi get his and cover everybody else and all that? And it's like, that's a thing, but Kawhi is an active participant in that discussion. And if you send no help at Kawhi, it's going to be a problem. And so I thought the best any team looked defending Kawhi was Milwaukee in the first two games of the series, because they said, here's what we're going to do. When you run a pick and roll, Brook Lopez is going to come up a little bit, but not so far. We're going to force you away from the screen or force you left. And we're going to sort of corral you in like a 8-square-foot area and dare you to take contested mid-range jumpers. And that's like, that you can live with. Like, if that's the end game, you can live with that. Looney is the only one of Golden State centers who can actually do that, because Cousins, he'll go right around or right into. Bogut, he'll go right around or right into. And the Warriors just haven't been able to find that balance of playing a Kawhi pick and roll almost 2-on-2 and staying home on everyone else, because Looney's the only one who can actually do it, and he's not 100%. And they haven't been able to go to their death lineup and switch everything because it hasn't been available to them. And so Kawhi has been able to sort of pick them apart. Lowry has been able to pick them apart on the pick and roll because the centers can't stay in front of them. And beyond that, the Raptors, I think in games 3 and 4, particularly 4, proved that they are now a multidimensional offensive team. That if you take that away, they can play the off ball split cut game like the Warriors play. They can get out in transition. And when they find any sort of help, their extra passing, the ball was flying around in game 4. It was really a testament to how versatile they are stylistically. It's not just like as simple as how much help do we send Kawhi, because A, that he alone makes that very complicated, and B, they got other stuff they do well now.
I mean, back in December when we did this, I think I mentioned, and something, I'm not a genius, but we mentioned it looked like they had the Kawhi offense and the Raptors offense. And at times in this playoffs, that's what it's looked like too. You know, especially in the Philadelphia series, where you can see Kawhi losing confidence in his teammates and his teammates losing confidence in their own shots. And, you know, literal and figurative bounces have gone their way over the course of the play.
But he gets more roles. He gets a role every game. Rim, backboard, every game on three.
I think he and Steph went roll three for roll three last game. Like, yeah. Both of them had an in, out, and in, back to back. And it's like, okay.
Start of the third quarter. Yeah. First Kawhi three rattled in and out.
Boy, that Kawhi sequence. Now, it wasn't quite a steal that was in between because Draymond kind of lost the ball, like, on his shoulder. But, like, he just took the ball. It's like, it's my ball. I'm taking it. And, like, that's what he was 2 years ago when I thought he was the MVP of the league. He would just have these 90-second periods in lots of games where he would almost single-handedly, like, go on a 9-0 run just by himself.
He did that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
In game six against Milwaukee, they were down 15 late in the third quarter, and Kawhi scored 8 of the next 10 points and assisted on the other two, and the Raptors were down 5 heading to the fourth.
But we were talking about that in December, and we've talked about it throughout, and Kawhi scored what, 17 points in the third quarter? Mm-hmm. Other than that first spurt, did it feel to either of you that it's like, oh, this is the Kawhi Leonard show. He's doing it all in the third. Like, in the first, it did feel like that to me. In the third, they scored 37 points. Kawhi had 17. And it wasn't like Kawhi's out there doing everything. Obviously, he was doing a hell of a lot. But he wasn't like this one-man. It wasn't this one-man show. And then in the fourth, it certainly was not.
No,
he had 5.
In the fourth quarter, he had the luxury of making a catch and shoot corner three like Danny Green on a pick and roll where Lowry saw that Kevon Looney was coming out far but was a little behind the play, read his feet, so he's not going to be able to reverse the momentum, just put his head down, went right around him, threw a no-look pass where he looked at Danny Green on the wing and hit Kawhi in the corner. I was like, oh, this is – Kawhi must have been like, oh, this is nice. Little spot-up catch and shoot three. Is this how you live, Danny Green? I could make like half of these.
They did a couple other ones where he was down in the dunker spot, popped out the little 8-foot jumper, right? Yeah. Like off a catch. But so he scored, I think, he hit those first two threes. And every Raptor, I asked Fred VanVleet after the game, what changed in the third quarter? And he came out with that wonderful, great line. Kawhi Leonard came out and hit a couple FU threes.
When did he lose his tooth? Was that in the third quarter?
Fourth quarter. Yeah. But like every Raptor said, once Kawhi hit those shots, the second one over Draymond Green after he gets the ball, he just walks right up to Draymond Green, crosses him once and says, watch this. Then they take the cue. Like the thing is, you can't say this team is just Kawhi Leonard because he has a team around him that in that third quarter, we have spent a lot of this playoffs, especially the Philly series going, it's Kawhi and everybody else. It's Kawhi and everybody else. And they had a couple games where it wasn't that, but he carried them on those shoulders for a lot of that series.
And they just had, two plays jumped out to me and I was rewatching part of the game this morning. One was a Kawhi ISO where the Warriors loaded up the floor on him and he passed to some outlet that was nearby and the Raptors threw 4 passes in 3 seconds and they were all simple passes, but it was next guy, next guy, next guy, and Serge hit an open long two. And there was another one in the first quarter where they ran an off ball screen between Kyle and Kawhi. Kawhi went into the post deep, caught the ball, drew help, kicked to Siakam, or maybe VanVleet, I can't remember, who swung it to Gasol, who pump faked and drove and swung it again, and then it got up to VanVleet, and there were, again, it was like 6 passes and a drive in 5 seconds, and Fred missed a wide open three, but it was like, man, they are just, if it starts with Kawhi, he doesn't have to finish. It can go in a million different directions.
And what it felt like in that third quarter was something closer to final form. In the Philly series, Brett Brown was terrified of the other shooters because once Marc Gasol became a Raptor, they became the best three-point shooting team in the league because all of a sudden the ball moved so much better because his unselfishness was contagious. But we talked about it. Kareem's right that Kawhi for a lot of the season felt like he was operating in almost a simulation, like he was practicing with 4 guys paid to be his teammates and 5 people paid to be defenders. He was working on stuff. And then the Raptors in the games without him would move the ball differently and their offensive hierarchy was obviously different. And so they did have kind of 2 offenses. And what you saw in that quarter to me was a melding of the two offenses where it all comes together, where Kawhi comes out and hits those two threes. And then you're in the position where Philly didn't want to send too much help, so Kawhi killed them. Milwaukee sent too much help, so other guys hit shots. The balance is difficult with this team.
That's what a star is. You have these conversations like it's easy, and sending no help at a star, sending no help at a real star, a 6'8" freaking dude that guys bounce off like he's like made of stone, sending no help is you lose. Like, and you just lose and your team fouls out. Like, it's not a magic solution.
But that what I mean by final form in this is the defense can go to levels that are hellacious, and then they can run and they can score in transition. And if you get an offense where you can't commit too much to either Kawhi or everybody else, and they finally know what they want to do in all the situations, which has not always been the case with this team, where all of a sudden it's instinctive and the ball's going to places and they see your weaknesses before you do. That is what this team's been working towards all year. All the experimenting, all the different lineups, all the Kawhi in and out of the lineup, Pascal as a lead option. It all came together in that third quarter.
I forget if it was before or after game three, whatever it was. I think it was after game three. Kawhi, in his press conference, said, "We just need to keep on playing in flow. Stop worrying about getting me the ball because that causes stagnation." And look, if he's saying it to us, he's probably said it to his teammates, one would assume, assuming Kawhi speaks, which he does. He said it to his teammates.
By the way, do we think that Kawhi is maybe in on the joke with like his ultra literal answers?
Yes.
Do we think that maybe he's in on it?
One of them, he literally smiled. Where are you after we was down 2-0 and is like, where do you go from here in the Milwaukee series? And it's like, game three, Toronto.
His answers are literally like step by step descriptions of mundane events that are going to happen or have happened. Yeah. I think he's in on it. I think he's having a little fun. Like, he realized, like, I'm kind of being ridiculous and people realize I'm kind of being ridiculous, so I'm going to be more ridiculous.
He's not into it to the level that OG Anunoby is in on it.
OG's been doing this deadpan, OG's like a little contemptuous of the media, I think. So there's a little deadpan, you know, going on.
Yes, I had a point.
Sorry if I interrupt. No, it's okay. If he's saying that,
he said it to his teammates a bunch of times. But, you know, he's basically saying that he sees what everybody else sees. And that means the Raptors see it. They're not, like, this team's not stupid. It's just a hard, like you said, it's a very hard balance to find. And it goes back to what I was trying to say earlier and can't because I'm not very eloquent. When he scored 17 points in the third quarter, other than those first six, I was never like, oh, Kawhi's going to work now.
Right.
It was like, he got the ball in flow and he made decisions. That was it. It wasn't like the Kawhi show.
And then he scored 11 more points in the final 3:18 of the quarter, which was again what he did in game six against Milwaukee. Same thing. But in between those moments, the first minute or so of the third quarter and the last 3:18, the Raptors carried the load. It wasn't just the Kawhi Leonard. It was the Raptors. You can argue whether he's the greatest, second greatest, third greatest player in the world. Take your pick. There's aesthetics there. There's decisions, whatever. This team at times is capable of living up to him. And when they do that, this team is what you saw in game four.
Now, again, there are games to be played and everyone's making the comparison to the 2014 finals because A, Kawhi, B, potential end of a three-peat quest and whatever else. And C, the way the games have flowed is the same way, where it feels as if the dam broke a little bit and the Raptors figured them out. And I will say it again. Even if it feels that way yesterday and today, it don't mean it's going to feel that way in the first quarter tomorrow. I have too much respect for the Warriors. They're too good for me to assume the series is over and assume that their will is broken and all this. I don't think their will is broken. I think they are going to come out tomorrow and make the Raptors earn it. So that said, this will be all of that aside. This will be the last question. Bruce, you touched on a little bit earlier talking about feeling like an other as a basketball fan. You guys are from here. This is only
Bruce is a dirty West Coaster.
Okay, whatever. I'm only a frequent visitor. why is this? I mean, Toronto sports fans are crazy, period. This is a crazy sports town. It's like a nice Boston, like a nicer Boston, like a nicer and like more polite and friendly Boston. There's just people just like sports for some reason in the bloodstream. People, FC Toronto moves here and plays a little itty bitty stadium and the team stinks and every game is sold out and there's sing songs and chants and toilet paper and all this stuff. But why is this become, why are there 40 Jurassic Parks? What would it, why does it mean so much to people here that they might win?
I'm not the first person to make this point. I think my colleague Blake Murphy made it on one of the other thing whenever we were talking to whoever knows. Too much talking for me. We the North, the slogan was this other, it came out of the whole idea of being othered. But it's not just being othered in the NBA, by 29 other teams from south of an arbitrary border. I mean, it's not so arbitrary, but, it's also within the city. Like, as somebody who grew up, I was 10 when the Raptors were born, and to me, the Raptors were as big as the Leafs, but that's not the way they were discussed. It was, if you liked basketball, you were like doing something not, I don't want to glamorize it and say it was radical, but it was marginal. It was like you felt marginalized. And there are, you know, it's like any championship or near championship run, there's been lots of bandwagoners coming on, which is fine. The more people that get to have a good time, as long as it's safe, is great. But to the people who always treated the Raptors as equals to the Leafs, and I would say, and maybe it's too close for me, but like my sort of peer group, that's how it felt. Like people who were 10 or 12 when the Raptors were born and had felt some sort of ownership over the franchise and some sort of stake in the franchise. This happening, not just to compare it to the Leafs, but this, you know, marginal thing becoming something of such huge importance is just, it seems so improbable. And that makes it so meaningful. If that, I don't know if that makes a ton of sense, but that's how it feels to me.
I will say this. I have a terrible sense of balance. My center of gravity is up in my chest. So when I tried to play hockey, I was terrible at it. I was a really lousy skater. There's a lot of people like that in this country. But for most of the people in this country, the number one participation sport is hockey. It is our religion. It is wended into what it means to be Canadian, not only at the rinks, but by the beer companies and by every advertiser and by every small town across the country that's got its own rink. Hockey is what we do. And it is tied beyond that inextricably to a sense of being Canadian. And if you are like, and I grew up loving hockey. I grew up being a fan of the Vancouver Canucks. I just couldn't play. But if you were loving basketball, which I did, because my dad loved both and he taught me both, taught me to love both, you were something different. It was just, it wasn't, it was like these little tribes. It wasn't like secret societies, but it just, you were in a different place than most of the other kids. And over all these years, when they got these two teams and we lost one of them, I used to be a partial season ticket holder for the Vancouver Grizzlies, basketball was still not the thing. The people who were making television programming decisions, advertising buying decisions, everything grew up as hockey fans. They didn't grow up as basketball fans. And what's happened over 24 years is this team, as we've discussed, went from being this novelty to this exciting new thing to this disappointment to this very successful joke. And what's happened now is finally, for the first time in our lifetimes, if you grew up loving the sport, it's the biggest game in town. This is the thing in this country right now. And there are 4 to 5 million people watching it on television, which is a number reserved, not even for the Stanley Cup final. Forget that. Without a Canadian team, you don't get that in a Stanley Cup final. But you're talking, this is what a Grey Cup, which is a national thing, gets. This is what a Super Bowl gets. And it is something where all of a sudden, basketball matters in this country at the highest level. And I think that's why you see viewing parties, not just outside this arena, because there's 6-7 million people within a half hour's drive of here. Of course you can get 15,000 people outside the arena, but you see it not only in the suburbs, you see it in Halifax, you see it in Vancouver, you see it across the country, because the tribes are finally coming out and they're adding more people and there's room in the Church of Basketball for everyone. And that's why I think it's so big. In a country where no major championship has been won by any team in this country, and I'm talking basketball, baseball, and hockey since 1993, it feels good to win, and it's basketball that's doing it. And it's all colliding in this one place, in this building, in this town.
I don't know how many times people in this city had to hear, you know, you talk about how great the crowds were for Raptors games and how even in the lean years, the attendance was pretty good. And what was the explanation for that? Well, all the Leafs fans had to buy Raptors tickets.
Yeah.
That's how you got Leafs season tickets. You had to buy Raptors tickets. And I think if they do go on and win, I think one of the more poignant moments will be after game four when Fred VanVleet was asked, do you feel like now that you've, you know, got your eye battered and lost, you know, a tooth or part of your tooth, do you feel more Canadian? And he was like, if that's what being Canadian is, I'm not sure I want it.
he was joking, to be clear.
He was joking, but basketball is its own thing. And right now it's the thing. And that's special for a lot of people. And also it's just fun to cheer on a winner.
It's fun to cheer on a winner. I'll let you guys leave it there. I will say it makes me scared for what will happen to this city if the Maple Leafs ever win the Stanley Cup again, because there might not be anything to come back to. And I'll say it again. The Raptors better not mess around in game five, because this is the Golden State Warriors and all this nice talk about what it would mean and this and that. Don't mess around with this team. Don't go back to Oakland. Don't give Oracle another game when they know it's, when they know then that it's the last game in Oracle. For sure. And don't chance a game seven here against Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and Kevin Durant. They better get it done tomorrow. I'm not saying they, if they lose tomorrow, they're going to lose the series. If they lose tomorrow, they are still a huge favorite to win the series, obviously. Let's remember who they're playing. They're not playing the Utah Jazz sneaking into the finals. This is a dynastic team that they're playing. So I expect it to be hard tomorrow. And that's all I got to say.
It should be hard. I will say this for this Raptors team, and this is, links back to what we're just talking about. If you're a Raptors fan, you're conditioned to expect disappointment. Masai Ujiri has told me for years and told all of us for years, why do you guys always expect the worst? Why do you think it's going to go wrong? Why don't you have confidence in this team, in yourselves as a city? And the answer is always experience. This is what people in this city have known. And what this team has proven so far is that in the biggest moments, in the hardest moments, they've been a team that you can believe in. And that doesn't mean they're going to win the series, but they have three chances to do it.
Three chances, and the first one is tomorrow. We will see what happens. I always appreciate you guys coming on. It's been a fun ride over the last few years doing our podcast as the Raptors became something that people actually cared about. We are, I don't know, 30 hours, 29 hours from tip-off of the biggest basketball game that's ever been played here, probably. So it will be fun. The atmosphere is going to be absolutely insane, and we will see what happens. Maybe I'll see you in Oakland, or maybe I'll see you next season or in Vegas or something. We'll see. Thanks, guys. The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.